Savvy regards once again to the staff of Nemeta, and a wonderful woof to the woke, coming from Lama Lovemut. Recently, you found a full recitation of the Dragonfly Sutra, and so now you have all 11 lines. And my intention in this talk is to give you some key instructions, some clear and precise instructions on how to use the Dragonfly Sutra, how to work with it, and how to recognize the unique properties of this little 11-line recitation. In another talk, and possibly text, in another unit entitled, Is Your Attention Sophia's Prompt? I will explain the two objectives, the two unique benefits of the Dragonfly Sutra, thereby to underscore its importance to those of you in Nemeta, its relevance to the Maitreya process, and so forth and so on. But for right now, let me go directly to the technical structure of the sutra by explaining it, by describing its explicit features. I intend to show you basically how to handle it and how to use it. In the first place, of course, follow the basic rule. Do not write down the Dragonfly Sutra. You don't need to write it down. Certainly, the memorization of the 11 lines is a feat within your reach. You know, there is a passage in a Platonic dialogue. It's either at the end of the Phaedrus, yeah. And in that dialogue, Socrates recounts an Egyptian legend concerning a conversation between Hermes, meaning an initiate of the Hermetic mysteries of Egypt, and King Thames, I think it is, T-H-A-M-E-S, after which, by the way, the River Thames has been named. And in that short passage, I'll find it and I'll put it in the text, put it in this unit as a text. You see that Hermes comes to the king intending to announce to him the wonderful news that he has invented writing. And of course, traditionally, the Egyptian god Thoth, Hermes in Greek, is attributed with the invention of writing. Well, as you may know, I've said before that the Teleste of the mystery schools were the ones who introduced the secular alphabets in the various regions of the Mediterranean. In antiquity, Robert Graves makes a huge point of this in his discussion of the Greek hero Cadmus, who sowed the dragon's teeth. The letters of the secular alphabet are the dragon's teeth. Wonderful story, wonderful mythophrenic parable there. In any case, Thoth, or Thoth, which simply means thought, it's equivalent to Manes and Manas, announces proudly that he has invented this tool of writing and what a benefit it will be. But the king wisely points out that as an aid to memory, taken as an aid to memory, in other words, if you want to remember something, you write it down, that particular technology will in fact subvert, erode, and damage the faculty of memory. Well, of course, the parable has a long outcome. The moral of that story is in itself a very long tale of the degeneration of the faculty of memory in the human species. Now, I myself, when I was a teenager, could remember and recite certain poetry, poems of Dylan Thomas, also poems from the Arthurian cycle of Tennyson. Today, I can't do that. Today, it would require an exceptional effort for me to memorize Idylls of the King by Tennyson, but at the age of 16, 17, earlier, I knew it by heart, as well as any number of poems by W.B. Yeats. So we're all in the same boat here. We're all suffering from the consequences of which the wise king spoke in that Platonic dialogue. Nevertheless, I venture to say it's no great feat for you to remember these 11 lines, so don't write them down. Now, I'm going to allude here to some factors of poetic craft that would properly be included in that course. Poetry is conventionally written in rhyme and meter. Well, what is meter? Well, meter is the composition of the lines of poetry consisting of various phonemic groups, which can be designated as iambic and trochaic. That concerns the accent on words. So when you study Shakespeare in high school, as I did, if anyone does anymore, you learn that Shakespeare's plays were written in iambic pentameter. To be or not to be, those are iambs. An iamb is two syllables with the emphasis on the second, to be or not to be. That's an iamb. The trochee is the opposite. It's two syllables with the emphasis on the first syllable. Now, you can recite the Dragonfly Sutra, and I advise you do so. And as you, by memory, recite the actual words, register in your mind that you are reading silently or pronouncing a series of iambs and trochees, a series of iambic and trochaic factors in the poem, along with a mix of others, which we don't need to get into. All you need to recognize at the beginning to make optimum use of the sutra is where the iambs occur and where the trochees occur. For instance, take the introductory word, which is the catalytic mantra of the sutra, tathagate, tathagate. That is two iambs clustered very tightly together. So when you say tathagate, you are reciting two iambs. And when you recite the first line, the beat of wings, that again is two iambs. The beat of wings. And the accent is on the second syllable in a two-syllable pronunciation. Now, how wonderful is that just at the beginning? Because in fact, in the impeccable lapidary construction of the Dragonfly Sutra, the two iambs, the beat of wings, repeat the two iambs of tathagate. Now, what is actually happening in your mind when you repeat the first line with the opening invocation word in Sanskrit? What is actually happening? Well, you're actually setting your mind to those beats. It's like setting your hands on the piano to the beat of a metronome. So as the metronome clicks back and forth, you play the piece on the piano, and as you follow the metronome, whatever its setting may be, whatever its rate may be, you are able to consistently play the music in the proper and timely succession of notes. You see how marvelously simple it is. The first line sets your mind on the beats. Now, what are the beats? Well, the beats are always happening in your mind anyway. There is always a series of beats playing in your mind. In fact, what are the beats? One of the enticing and enigmatic questions that comes to mind with the first line is, what are the beats? The beat of wings. Does the beat of wings make a sound? Well, go down a little further to the fourth line, and what do you hear? Makes not a sound. So when you recite the fourth line, when you get down to that line in the succession of the recitation, it actually refers to the first line. The beat of wings makes not a sound. This is an instruction to what is happening in your mind perpetually. You see, at the subliminal level, which is the level in which you are receptive to DI or Dakini instruction, what you actually hear are beats. You hear beats before you hear the music or language attached to the beats. The paradox is, of course, that you don't hear anything at all because the beats are silent. The beat of wings makes not a sound. Nevertheless, you hear it, as if I recite to you, Mary had a little lamb, a little lamb, a little lamb. Mary had a little lamb, and six beats follow. Mary had a little lamb, and six beats follow. You hear the line, whose fleece was white as snow. That's three IAMs, by the way. IAMB, whose fleece was white as snow. You hear it, but in fact, it makes not a sound. So if I recite Mary has a little lamb, and you recite it with me together, let's do that. Mary had a little lamb, a little lamb, a little lamb. There, we together recite in silent recitation, or what is called subvocal, the last line. And when you recite the last line without speaking it verbally, you can actually detect that the last line comes to your mind, the language, the words come to your mind, carried on those six beats, the three IAMs. This is how all thought works. I was shown this, by the way, in Nepal in March of 1966 when I wrote that strange piece of magical realism called Prost. So I was shown this. I was instructed in what I'm telling you now in the Himalayas, in the mountains of Nepal in March of 1966. So when you recite the Dragonfly Sutra, you, each time you do so, whether it be in its entirety or by selected lines, you are actually amplifying and enhancing your ability to sense the wordless beats. Now just think of what a beat is. Just think of someone playing the drums. You're sitting there in the room with a friend who's playing the drums. And they are hitting the drums with sticks, producing percussive sounds in the air. The vibrations of those sounds go through the air and they reach your ears, and they are converted miraculously through the auricular channel of the ear, which resembles a seashell spiral and is represented in the symbol of the goatfish. Through the auricular channel of the ear going into the neuronal nerve system, they are converted in some miraculous way, which can never be sufficiently explained, into sounds that you hear. But do you hear the actual beat of the drum beats? No. You hear the drum beats, you hear the percussive sounds, but you do not hear the beat, because the beat, which is the rhythm or cadence or proportion of the sounds, makes no sound. So your thought, as you have it normally, is always operating mysteriously on the borderline between sound and silence. This is an instruction you can draw from the Dragonfly Sutra. Now let me return to the technical point concerning poetic craft. When you write a line of poetry, or when you look at any written line of poetry, you can immediately parse it. I don't think it's called parsing. There's a technique where you use two symbols. One is like a flat kind of U symbol, and the other is a stroke. So you put a U symbol over every syllable that is not accented, and a stroke over the syllables that are accented. This is how you analyze and annotate a line of poetry. So if you were to do that with the beat of wings, you would put one of those U-shaped or horseshoe-shaped, flattened horseshoe, over the and of, and you would put a check mark or stroke over beat and wings. This is a routine practice in the study of poetic craft. And it gets better. The fundamental technique contained in the construction of the Dragonfly Sutra uses iambic and trochaic groups of words to direct your attention to the operations of your mind in complete stillness and clarity of presence. It does that. The sutra itself does that. You don't have to think about it. It does it by itself. It is designed to do just that. And it does so due to the way that iambs and trochees are distributed through the 11 lines. And it does so due to the fact that that distribution is extremely precise and intentional. Even though when I composed the Dragonfly Sutra, if you can call it that, I did not sit down and technically work out what I'm telling you now. It just came out in the structure of the sutra as the sutra spontaneously revealed itself. And that's how it happened. And it gets even better. Remember that I've emphasized, what does the Dragonfly Sutra do? I invite you, always return to this question. Always return to this point. Imagine that you're having a discussion with someone, and you're talking about Dog Zen and the Dragonfly Sutra. And if someone asks you, well, what is the Dragonfly Sutra? And this is the answer. It's a description of the flight of dragonflies. Period. It does not contain any metaphysical or dogmatic attributions, assumptions, speculations. Although I claim that it not only describes the operations of mind, but hones and improves your powers of attention, I do not necessarily say how it does that. You don't have to break it down and add metaphysical or noetic syntax. It is already impeccable noetic syntax. And by running it through your mind, you clear and sharpen your faculty of attention. The technique of using it involves paying attention to the iambic and trochaic composition. Let's look at another line. Moving on air. Now that is a trochee constructed back to back with an iamb. You say moving, you don't say moving. So when the emphasis is on the first syllable of a two-syllable unit, that's a trochee. Moving on air. On air, with the emphasis on the second word, is an iamb. So what do you observe? What happens in your mind? What happens to your mind when you recite these lines? The beat of wings moving on air. The construction of the beats first coming in two iambic units that repeat tathagate, and then coming in a trochee linked end to end with an iamb, moving on air, you have the beat of the dragonfly's wings installed in your mind by those two technical aspects of the construction. Now, the movement of dragonfly wings is complex, and it involves doubling and then doubling again. In other words, the set of front wings is a pair in itself. The set of back wings is a pair in itself. And the two pairs are, and the two pairs make a pair in itself. So you have two pairs. And what are these pairs? Well, they are like the iambic unit and the trochaic unit of soundless notes in your mind. Do you get that? That's what they are. You don't have to even learn how that could possibly be what they are. All you have to do is realize it as it's happening. Register those beats when you recite the sutra, either subvocally, which means you don't pronounce the words aloud, or vocally. In effect, you could say, by taking note, by bringing your attention to those units, the iambic and trochaic units, you are, in fact, installing the Dragonfly Sutra in your mind as a permanent asset of your mind. And to some degree, It takes over your mind. So, once again, let's consider another line. Measures a slight delay. That's the ninth line. Measures a slight delay. Do you say measures or do you say measures? You say measures a slight delay. Now the word delay is iambic, emphasis on the second syllable. The word measures is trochaic, measures. And then between them, a slight. Now, if you emphasize the word slight, then it becomes an iambic, doesn't it? So listen, measures a slight delay. So when you repeat it over and over again, and you simultaneously pay attention to these accents, you learn to repeat it in a more and more or ever more subtle manner. You not just repeat the lines mechanically, but you bring subtlety to the emphasis of the words by following the beats. Measures a slight delay. See that? Now, there's a parallel. There are many parallels, mirrorings, and doublings in the Dragonfly Sutra. Again, in order to describe the flight of a dragonfly, you have to describe how all four wings work in consonance, how they all work in precise and delicate cooperation. So you're really building a view of four wings operating in two pairs, aren't you? And if you go and look at some nature photography in slow motion of the wings of a dragonfly in flight, then you will be able to see what the sutra actually describes. And that's a good thing to do. In fact, I'll link to one of those clips of nature photography. There are many, many of them, of course. So, there's a parallel between the beginning of the sutra and what follows the sixth line. Remember, there is a comma in the sixth line. On its own. And the stroke. There's a comma in the sixth line. The comma is similar to the body of the dragonfly. You're at the middle of the sutra, right? The body of the dragonfly, the hull, has the two pairs of wings positioned. The two pairs of wings are hinged, that's the word I was looking for, on the hull. The hinge is indicated by the comma. And sure enough, in the next line, and the stroke that lifts the hull to flight. So in the seventh line, you have the word hull, which refers to the body of the dragonfly where the two pairs of wings are attached. And it's perfectly logical in the description that the hull would be described after the stroke, because the strokes of the wings are made off the hinges on the hull. And the stroke that lifts the hull to flight. Six syllables, three iambs, that lifts the hull to flight. And when you reach the end of that line, you have installed the Dragonfly Sutra in your mind to the point where the sutra takes over your mind. Up until that line, you are preparing your mind to be taken over by the sutra. By taken over, I mean, of course, entrained. And this is a benign entrainment. Now, it so happens in the situation of the human animal that the mechanical tool of the mind, which is not alive, but serves as a tool for living intelligence, is extremely susceptible to being entrained, particularly when you take into consideration the neoteny of the human animal. And so your mind has been and continues to be massively entrained by whatever you give your attention to. So if you give your attention to an advertising jingle or a YouTube clip or a pop song or a song composition by Mozart or anything whatsoever, the content that comes to the attention of your mind will to some degree entrain your mind. But consequently, the human mind is entrained by an enormous amount of bullshit, extraneous material, distraction, not to mention deliberate deceit and lies, and a lot of garbage and pollution through advertising, through music, anything that gets your attention. Consider, for instance, the experience when you're in the supermarket and they're playing music over the sound system. It's entraining your mind, and you can't get away from it. However, with the entrainment provided by the Dragonfly Sutra, the strength of resistance to extraneous and nefarious entrainment will be highly enhanced and increased. So, to continue with this fascinating point drawn from the Course on Poetic Craft, the sutra can be seen to be composed of iambic and trochaic units with others scattered in. I won't go into the variations at the moment, but I'll give you an example of one. On its own, comma, and the stroke, comma. What do you have there? Well, you have at the hinge point in the sutra, the sixth line, you have two different syllabic constructions that consist of two unaccented syllables followed by an accented syllable. On its own. You emphasize the word own, don't you? You get the subtle emphasis of the word own. The emphasis on the word own is the beat of the word, but the beat makes no sound. On its own. How can the beat make a sound? Well, that's the mystery of language, my friends. So, both on its own and the stroke, the six words in the sixth line, belong to another element of poetic composition. I forget what that's called. I'll go look it up. So, to conclude, I can't really conclude. I choose not to fully conclude this instruction. There will be a part two. I need to look something up, or maybe I won't find it, in which case I'll just forge ahead. But what I'm going to tell you now, I don't know how to say this. No Buddhist, Chan, or Zen master has ever, ever said this, has ever elucidated this. But they have, in Chan, they have intimated what I'm going to tell you now. I would need to find the passage. It comes from, I think, a Chan master or perhaps a Japanese master. It concerns the self-evident mystery of what is happening in your mind. And it goes like this. It's a simple statement of fact, which you can confirm by observation. You cannot trace either where your last thought arose, nor can you trace where your next thought will arise. Now stop just a moment. Pause this recording and reflect on that. You cannot track or trace where your last thought arose, nor where it dissolved. And you cannot track or trace where your next thought will arise. Arise and dissolve. Thoughts arise and dissolve. Your attention goes spontaneously to thoughts that arise and dissolve. Now let me ask you, if you're sitting, say in your car, you get into your car and you're going to go to the grocery store. So you sit in your car, you turn the ignition and the car goes on. You could say that the last thought you had before you got in your car was the thought of going to the grocery store. But that's a very gross approximation, because after you had the intentional thought, I'm going to the grocery store, between the moment that you had that thought and the moment you got in the car and turned on the ignition of the car, you had other thoughts, didn't you? What thought did you have 2 minutes ago, 20 minutes ago? What thought did you have 20 minutes ago? How did that thought arise? Did you observe how it arose? Where from did it arise? Did you observe how it dissolved? Your process of working with your own mind consists of being continually in this liminal state where you attend to thoughts that arise and thoughts that dissolve. Now, here is the formula inherent in the iambic and trochaic composition of the Dragonfly Sutra. The iambs entrain your attention to the phenomenon of the last thought you had. The trochees entrain your attention to the phenomenon of the coming thought, which you haven't had yet. Now, the way to remember that is quite simple. In the iam of two syllabic units, the emphasis is on the second unit, the beat. With the iam, the emphasis on the second or last unit refers you to the last thought you had, which arose and dissolved mysteriously. The trochee puts emphasis on the first unit, measures on the first unit, moving. The iambic intonation, excuse me, the trochaic intonation here directs your mind to the perpetual mystery of the arising of your next thought, because the emphasis is on the first syllable. What comes first is what comes next. First thought is always next thought, and first thought is always best thought. That's a trope in Zen Buddhism. First thought, best thought. The next thought is always the first thought, emphasis on the first syllable. The last thought that you just had becomes keyed to your attention by the emphasis on the last syllable. Can it get more simple than that? Now that is premium Chan and Zen instruction. And I'm happy to say that I can offer that. And I'm grateful to say that I can base it on a sort of pre-existing paradigm that you find in Chan and Zen teachings, and I'll dig it up if I can. And it gets even better, but I'm not going to go there now because this is pretty intense. So I'll leave it at that, but I'll pick up with the second part of this instruction with a further elucidation on the phenomenon of the last thought you had and the next thought that you're going to have. And I will describe explicitly how the sutra enhances and sharpens your awareness of those mental events according to the features of its construction. Tathagata.